Okay, good evening, everyone. We are on round two. We are discussing part two of navigating religion with non-religious relatives and friends and the like. That's our goal for this evening. It's a little bit different than last class. The reason why it's a little bit different is because we're going to talk about certain practical scenarios, and if you have practical scenarios you want to discuss, I'm happy to discuss those as well. So, I'd like to hear people's responses. I've heard some, but I'd like to hear people's responses if anyone had any experience over the last week, what you felt, what you thought, and if you actually tried anything out with anybody. Like, did you try out, like, I just found out? You know, that's a great one to try. So if anybody had that, you know, let me know at any point. But otherwise, we continue. There is a point that I did mention last week, and I want to mention again this week, and that is that when a person goes through their journey and they go through their experience of religiosity, in the beginning, they're oftentimes going to feel judged by the ones that are not religious. They're going to feel judged by the ones that are not religious. One of the reasons why they're going to feel judged is they're going to say, oh, you're crazy, or you're this or that. And the reason where it's coming from is because those that are, quote-unquote, judging you at that point, suggesting to you that you're crazy to want to take upon yourself this journey, part of the reason why they're getting there is because they're afraid, like, this is going to really ruin my life or my relationship with that person. And therefore, you know, either it's going to be pressure on me to do certain things, or it's just going to be a real hassle to have to live with this, or I'm going to feel like I'm not living up to what I'm supposed to be living up to. So therefore, they want to convince you out of it, and they're going to actually judge you for it. So it's not because they have a firm belief as to why you should or shouldn't follow this this religious thing, but it's because it's something that's really hitting them hard, and it's difficult for them. So that's part A. Part B is that once we become religious, then those friends really feel they're being judged in a deep way. And how do we stop that? I don't know if we can stop it necessarily, but they do really feel that they're being judged. No matter what move they take, you're judging them for something negative. Because you have, quote-unquote, seen the light, and that light is beautiful. Now, if I see that you're not seeing that light, it's like, really? You can't do this? So they feel like they're being judged. Now, are they wrong? So part of the answer, I think, is they're not wrong. Part of the answer, I think, is that sometimes we do judge them. Maybe it's because we were being judged the whole time before. That could be. Or maybe it's just because we feel like, you know, we're not seeing eye to eye, so I look negatively upon that other person. And there might be a piece of us that actually does actually judge them negatively, as opposed to judging them in the most beautiful light. Oh, come along with me this journey and jump on my back. You know, we have this, you know, wonderful little caravan. And we're not doing that. We're like, hey, what are you doing already? Like, who are you kidding? And there's an element of judgment that happens over there. So there is a sense of trueness that we have to look into ourselves, that perhaps maybe we are have a tinge, or more than a tinge, of actual negative judgment on that. So that's just a reality check within ourselves. Like, why would we be judging them? And should we be judging them? And what should we do about it? So that's going to bring us into our next topic. The next topic is going to be, within that, is Lashon Hara. Is speaking negatively about those people that are not following the Torah and the mitzvot properly. Am I allowed to? Should I? Should I not? Like, what's the story over here? So there's a number of different aspects of halachic literature, of Jewish law, that we have to discuss this concept. the first thing is that when it comes to saying Lashon Hara, saying something negative about somebody else. Now, the Torah tells us, Lo telech rachel b'amecha, lo selech rachel b'amecha, you shall not be a gossip monger amongst your people. And that generally refers to the people that are osei maisa amcha, the people that are doing the actions of your nation, which means those people that are keeping Torah and mitzvos, you should not be a gossip monger, you should not say Lashon Hara about them. What does that mean? Says the Gemara. Well, that means only those people that are fulfilling Torah and mitzvot should you not speak about. Everybody else, fair game. You know, Jose or whomever, you know, and we can say anything we want about you because either you're not Jewish or you're not religious, you don't fulfill mitzvot, so I can just rail at you, I can speak about you, I can speak negatively about you. That's what it would seem on the surface when you understand that. Question is that true? Before I take your question. So that's what the Chafetz Chaim writes in the laws of Lashon Hara, is that technically, if a person is not fulfilling Torah and mitzvahs based on this Gemara, it would seem on the surface, again, on the surface, that you would be able to say anything you want about them. So the question is that really true, and especially in these cases that we have? So we're going to look about two different types of people in particular. There are two types of people. There's one that is called a Rasha, an evildoer. We'll describe what a Rasha is. And another one that's called an Apikores. An Apikores is how we translate a heretic. Someone who's blatantly going against that. Just to remember a story that, I forgot what the, I don't remember the context of the story. This, I guess it was a little girl, little Israeli girl, went into a makolot, went into a little supermarket while they were in Israel, and she was like 3 years old, and either the mother asked her to go get peaches, and peaches in Hebrew is afarsak, and she went into the store and she says, "Ani rotza apikores," you know, I want an apikores, you know, apikores is a heretic and it's not a peach, you know, so there is a clear distinction between peaches, which grow on a tree, and a heretic, which does not. That's one difference between them. So an apikores is what the Gemara gives the terminology. An apikores is someone who goes against the Torah with deliberate reasons. Deliberate reasons means they're going against the Torah because it's the Torah. What does that mean? It means the classic example is you give them two options. Say, hey, I can give you a kosher piece of meat over here and a non-kosher piece of meat. They go, I'm not taking the kosher one. I'm just going to go for the non-kosher one. Assuming they're both equal, I don't want it. I'm not touching it. I don't want anything to do with it. I'm only going to take the non-kosher piece. Why? They're both equal. Why would you do that? Because I want to go against it. So that's the concept of what we define as a heretic. that type of person, there is a mitzvah to speak Lashon Hara about them. Get this. There is a mitzvah. A mitzvah to speak Lashon Hara about them. We'll see today, before everyone jumps to conclusions, that you probably don't have one of those in your family. This is being recorded. But you probably do not have one of those in your family, and we'll see in a moment. It's a mitzvah to speak bad about them, and you're supposed to speak negative about them. We have to see, like, why? Like, why did I become such a mean person and I'm going to speak negatively about them? That is case number one. Case number two is a Rasha. What is a Rasha? What's an evil person? So you and I think an evil person is the one who is like mugging people and robbing banks and doing all these things. A Rasha is a person who's not fulfilling the will of God, who's not fulfilling the mitzvah, and is continually, repeatedly violating a mitzvah. What does that mean? But I know my friend Chaim Yankel, he's such a sweet guy, he has so much chesed, he does beautiful things, but he does these sins. So is he a Rasha? But he does all this chesed, he does all this kindness. The answer is you can be a partial Rasha. You can be a tzaddik in one area, and you can be a Rasha in another area. You can be living a dual life, right? Everybody can be, which means you can be considered a righteous person by doing this correctly, but in this particular mitzvah or sin, you are a Rasha. That's the concept. So now you have a person who is considered what we'd call a Rasha, again in those quotes, because they're violating a certain sin, and they're repeatedly violating that sin. But that individual is not doing it as out of animosity towards the Torah. It's just something that they do. They're used to doing this. This is their experience. They enjoy themselves, what we call a mumer l'teyavon. They're repeatedly violating, but it's because they like pork or whatever it is. This is what they do. It's not because simply they're going against the Torah. They don't have a desire to go to break the Torah. They just enjoy themselves and what they're doing. So this type of person, you can only say negative things about them. You can only say Lashon Hara about these types of people if it's number one, to bring them to do tshuva, to get them to repent, or number two, to prevent other people from aligning with them, to protect other people who might interact with them. Those are your two options. Now, with those two options, there are four other stipulations that need to be said in order to say that Lashon Hara. One, you saw the sin that they did. Two, you don't exaggerate the sin that they've done. Three, you don't immediately jump to conclusions. And four, you wouldn't hide yourself from saying it in front of them. Which means if they came to you and said, what's the problem? Look, you're driving, you know, you're whatever things that you're doing. You're you know, you're eating pork or whatever. I'm just using that example. I'm sure everyone has a relative like that, whether someone watches it, you know, you're violating Shabbos. You don't feel bad about saying it to them. Okay? So again, you saw the sin, you're not going to exaggerate, you don't immediately jump to conclusions, and lastly is, you wouldn't hide yourself from saying to them directly. And of course, it's for one of those two other major categories. There's a positive purpose. Either you want them to repent, to bring them to tshuva, or you're trying to prevent other people from interacting with them. That means that most of the people we're going to be dealing with are going to be in that category. The only reason why you'd be speaking negatively about them is to help other people or to actually help them.
What about the person who, say, is like eating like pork or something and like hides it because they see you coming, almost as if they feel ashamed?
So that's even better.
But they're going to do it anyway.
That's even better. What does that mean, it's even better? It means they have what's called busha. They have embarrassment, which means they're at a higher level already. They respect you and they respect the fact that it's wrong, but they can't control themselves. You know, so it's like you say to them, like, wow, that's really, you know, I really commend you, that's really special, that you sense the sensitivity for me, that you're doing that, that's, you know, I really appreciate that, you know. So it's a higher level than someone just like, oh, no problem. You know, I remember a rabbi told me once, he's like, he had a meeting with somebody, and the guy, and it was a rabbi, you know, a long bearded rabbi, goes to the store, meets with the person, and the guy gets a ham and cheese sandwich, you know, and he's like, I'm the rabbi, you eating that in front of me? Like, really? Like, you have no embarrassment there, so in your case, it's even better. Person is showing that they have some sort of connection. I just want to go back to this question of apikoros. The apikoros that we're talking about, that we said before, is the person who's a heretic, where you're supposed to say negative things about, you're supposed to, whatever, rip into them. The reason why you're doing it is because you need to distance that person from all other Jews. And they're so against the Torah, they don't want to hear anything. So you speak negatively about them because either it's going to, they're going to feel bad that they're being spoken about, or you're protecting other Jews. But there are no stipulations to that individual. You don't have to say public, private, you know, you don't have to worry about it. It's like they're going against it in a blatant way in order to attack. In that scenario, you don't have to come up with stipulations. However, the Chazon Ish, great sage of our time in the 1950s, said, and nowadays we really don't have anyone that we can categorize as an apikoros. Most people are coming from a sense of not knowing anything. To truly become a heretic, you have to know Torah and then break from the fold. Most people do not know anything, so it's very hard for them to break away from nothing, because they don't have any concept of that. so that's an important factor. So really what that would mean is that we're going to look at people and say, hold on a second, should I say something negative about them? Maybe yes, because of the fact that, you know, other people need to know, or because I want to help them, or perhaps we'd say some other positive purpose. How can I deal with those people? How would I be able to react to deal with those people properly? That's the only reason why you're doing it. You know, and you're not doing it, you're not exaggerating, you're not saying these things, especially when you're not intending for Lashon Hara. That's a separate story. We had two questions.
So speaking about Russia, so that's the person...
Russia, not the country.
Not Russians. Russians are great.
Okay.
Not Russians are great. Russians are here are great.
Okay.
So you do some mitzvahs, you don't know the other mitzvahs, which is fine. But at the same time, there are some mitzvahs, if you don't do, actually 36 or 39 of them, you're cut off from the nation of Israel.
Okay.
So what do they consider? It's not, is it, you know, like in general, it's not considered Russia anymore.
It's, why not?
Because... If you're cut off from the nation of Israel...
So it's everything. That idea of kares over there is not referring to you being the judge of that kares. I don't think that's you being judging them over here. In this case over here, those things that they're doing is what we call a mumer l'te'avon. They're doing it out of desire, their own personal desires. And we're not at the place where we have a right to cut them off. We have a right to try to bring them back. It's going to be our next topic, which is rebuke. How do you rebuke people? Or should you be rebuking these people? Right? So if you listen to certain people on their MP3s or their class, like, you got to tell everybody that they're going to burn, and it's going to be super hot burning, and if you don't tell them, you're in trouble because they're all dying, and it's your fault. So that's one approach. But we'll see halachically does that actually apply. So that's going to be our next topic, and that's going to be actually going to rebuke.
I had a question about that, our next topic.
So we'll go with that next topic. The next topic is that of rebuke. So the Talmud tells, the Gemara in Yevamos tells us the following scenario. Just like there's a mitzvah to rebuke a person, as the Torah tells us, "Hochech tochiach es amisecha," you shall rebuke. You shall give rebuke to your amisecha, to the person who is part of your am, right, part of your nation. So just as there's a mitzvah to give rebuke to someone who will listen, there's a mitzvah to not rebuke if you know the person's not going to listen. That's what the famous Gemara is quoted, and that's usually where people stop quoting. Okay? That's the one famous sign. Just like there's a mitzvah to rebuke so the person will change, there's also a mitzvah to not rebuke if you know they're not going to change. Okay? That's one Gemara. There's another Gemara in Erechon that says, Rabbi Tarfon wonders, and just paraphrasing, he wonders, is there anybody in his generation that has a right to give rebuke? In his generation. So obviously for us in his generation. What about our generation? Anybody in our generation has the right to give rebuke? So these are the two famous Gemaras that are associated with it. Now, that being said, which sounds like, wait a minute, great, you know, I'm not rebuking anybody. If a person's going to violate anything, I don't have to tell them they're doing it. Why? Because number one, if I know they're not going to listen, so I can't rebuke them. I shouldn't rebuke them. Number two, who am I in my generation to actually give rebuke? So that's the famous question. So basically, what comes out from this Gemara, with the later commentaries, Tosfos explains this idea, is that the only time you don't give rebuke is if you are certain, with 100% certainty, whatever that number is, 99%, you're certain that they're not going to listen to that rebuke. But if you are in doubt whether they will listen to that rebuke, you're not sure, then you should give rebuke. This question is going to be, so how do I give rebuke? You know, what am I doing? Am I coming there with, you know, guns blazing? You know, am I just coming there with, like, you know, documents showing them, you know, that, you know, whatever I can show them to show that they're in trouble for their lives, you know, and you wasted your life away? Is that what I'm going to do? Am I going to just sit there yelling at them? So, we go through a couple other commentaries. And again, some of this is a little bit dry, but it's just to get to the bottom line so we know, okay, so how do I deal practically in this situation? The Ramah, codifier of the Shulchan Aruch alongside with Rav Yosef Kairos, the Ramah writes, and in Or HaChaim, it's a mitzvah to rebuke in private, even if they're not going to accept your rebuke. It means you have a person. What? How to define rebuke?
Yeah.
I would define rebuke as tell someone they're doing something wrong. I'm just going to go with the person and go, hey, Bob, you know, Leto, give me fill in the blank. Give me one. You know you're not allowed to?
Drive in Shabbos.
You're not allowed to drive in Shabbos, Bob.
Or eat pork.
Hey, Bob, you're not allowed to drive in Shabbos or eat pork, right? You're not allowed to drive while you're eating pork either on Shabbos, right? So let's say, right, so the Ramah says that, you know what, even though we just said before that just like it's a mitzvah, they're not going to listen. Wait, hold on, we're clarifying this, and that means... What does it mean? In private, do it. In private, tell them. In private, you should tell the person that they're doing something wrong. Because if they're not told, who's going to tell them? however, though there is a mitzvah that we're supposed to rebuke a person, if they're going to hate you or they're going to take revenge on you for this, so then there's no mitzvah. So you have to know. You have to know who you're talking to. If they're going to be really offended by what you're saying, then it may be that there's no mitzvah for you to actually say it. So even though the Ramah said, hey, listen, in private, tell the person, but the fact is, if you know they're going to be totally angry at you, then there's not going to be a mitzvah to actually say it.
So, a quick question about that. So, is that why, if a rabbi is actually talking to someone who is actually violating Shabbos in front of him, and there's other people around, he's not going to say anything to that person?
Well, we'll see why he's not going to say anything. Like, I remember someone told me an amazing story. He said, you know, one of the things that helped him become religious is that he, a man with a pure heart, he had moved into the town. So what the rabbi would do is that as the rabbi left shul, he would ensure that other congregants would surround him, so he wouldn't have to, quote-unquote, notice that the other guy was going to go into his car, right? So he did it, what he said, the rabbi did it with such tact that he wanted it to be seen that he wasn't looking at, any of these things. We're going to see that there's one is public, and the other one is how we're going to do this properly to possibly rebuke, right? We're going to see that in our generation today, it's a little bit different the way that people follow or don't follow things. People have fallen away so far from religion that they didn't actually even grow up with religion to be able to be considered the person who's running away, that we cannot rebuke. So just to quote, in the Sefer, Takanas HaShavim quotes from a number of authorities. I'll just mention it in case, why not? From the Sefer, Shut Kinyan Torah, Aruch HaShochan, Rav Azil Arbach Zatzal, that when we're dealing with non-religious Jews, what we call chilonim, when we're dealing with non-religious Jews, there is no mitzvah to rebuke them. Not even like, you know, hey, don't do that. There's no mitzvah. But they make a clarification. The clarification is, in public, there should be public rebuke. What is public rebuke? Not that this guy is a violator, but rather we want to show that we don't align ourselves with this idea. Everyone needs to know, we don't drive on Shabbos. Everybody needs to know, we don't eat pork. You need to know this, okay? To the individual, I may not go over say anything to them. But you need to know what our views are so people should not be misconstrued and to understand where we're actually coming from. And that's why in Israel you see these major protests that happen for the Chilonim, against the Chilonim, the Haredim. They have major, major protests, what they call a Hafgana. They have these major protests. But on the individual basis, it's like, you know, hi, how you doing? Nice to see you. Good Shabbos, whatever, nothing else, nothing more than that. So there is this category over here that we're not in a place to rebuke against people or to rail at them, to tell them they're actually doing things wrong. Rather, they suggest, do what you can do to bring them closer to Torah. Don't find what they're doing wrong and try to yell at them and scream at them. Do whatever you can do to actually bring them to bring them close to the Torah. there are those that still say there's a mitzvah to rebuke them. Hey, you know, because otherwise how are they going to ever know? And the reason why you're going to rebuke them is fascinating. The reason why is because we said, the verse says, you must rebuke the people who are part of your nation. Well, wait a minute, they're not doing anything that makes them part of the nation, so I don't have a right to rebuke them. Well, if I don't have a right to rebuke them, maybe they're considered a real Russia, a real evildoer. The answer is no. You should still rebuke them. Because the reason why they're not doing is not because they're running away from the fold and they know information. They don't really know information, and therefore we want to bring them back in. So the rebuking here is actually a positive thing. By the fact that I'm going to go over to the person and say, hey, you shouldn't do that. It means I care about you. It means I still feel that you're part of my people. I don't feel like you've exited the fold of our people. And that's why rebuke is a positive thing. And we usually look at it as a negative thing. But the fact that I'm still going to rebuke is because I care about you. You just have to be careful as to how you do it. And again, as we mentioned, we should do it in such a way where we're trying to bring people in. That's going to be. Not like, stop doing this, you know, loser, you failure, you know, your grandfather's screaming in the grave, you know, these kind of things. That's not the ideal way to go. Unless you feel like that's working. any questions on that now? Go ahead.
So, okay, so let's say you've done it once, you've reviewed someone privately once, and you had a conversation about it, and the next time they do the same thing, you're done, right? Or are you?
Well, the question is, are you done? Really, no. You're not done. Because in most cases, first of all, according to the Gemara, you're not done. You still have to do more. But if the fact is that you've presented a scenario to them, you know, and now their mind has to grapple with it, and now they're going to struggle. And you're going to come back to them a month later and go, hey, how are you doing? I know, remember we spoke about, you know, this whole idea of, you know, not murdering people. How are you doing with that, you know? Like, is it working well? I know living in the inner city and, like, you know, you have a lot of guns and stuff, but, like, is that working? Have you killed less people this month than last month, you know? Like, you want to work with them in that level of rebuke, you know?
What if they respond negatively to your first step?
So, which is what? Give me an example of negative.
You should have a circumcision. You know, and negative would be, like, I don't believe in this, I don't want to do it, you know, I don't know, a thousand other things.
Right, so your response to them, you know, a few weeks later, or whatever it is going to be something like, hey, listen, I just wanted to follow up. Have you researched into the whole idea of circumcision? Because it would be really amazing for you to have it. You know, you really need to get it. Right? And if they get spoken to in that way, I'm not putting you down. It's just like, it's going to be, you really need to do this. Come on, you need it for yourself, for your spirituality, for your soul, you know? It's like, you have to be able to do it, you know? By the way, we never know what thing we're going to say to a person that's going to shift their mind. You never know. A lot of times we like to be the, what we call, the quarterback of the whole scenario. Like, I made this guy religious. I did. It was me. Right? And like, huh?
Can I comment?
Go ahead.
At work, like half of my coworkers are Jewish.
Right.
It's not a Jewish place, but it's like half Jewish. And I'm like the only religious one. So they kind of just naturally, if they have a question about Judaism, they'll come to me. So around the holidays, one of my coworkers, talking about the holidays, and she was like, I'm not gonna go to shul, but I think I should. And then fast forward like a few days, like, I think I'm gonna go to shul, and somehow she said because of me.
Because of you, right?
Because of me, she's...
Sometimes it happens.
There's nothing that I did.
Right, but it's not me. It didn't mean... obviously, it's a start. And we always love to be the one who starts it, especially if we instigate and we go, hey, you should really go to shul. And I went because of you, obviously. But what my point is that when it comes to the whole journey that a person has, rarely is it one person that actually does it. But you never know how you act, especially if you act properly, what's going to be. I just shared this story. I just thought the story was amazing that Rabbi Nachman Seltzer came into Valley Torah 2 days ago, yesterday actually, and he spoke. And he had all these amazing stories. So one story is a bit of a baffling story. The story was that there was a guy who grew up on a chiloni kibbutz, totally irreligious kibbutz. Somehow he became religious, and it seemed like his uncle had passed away. And they asked him, can you come to the funeral? You know? So, okay, I'm coming to the funeral, but he's somewhat newly religious. And he doesn't really know all the, you know, all the speeches, all the like that you're supposed to say. But he goes to the funeral. So whoever got up to do the funeral was speaking in like, you know, some bizarre tone, like totally irreligious. Like he said a fake Kaddish that was, you know, didn't mention anything about like any essence of God or anything like that. It was just like a whole bizarre experience. So the cousins who were there, you know, to the relatives who passed away, they said, you know what, we just didn't feel comfortable. Would you mind doing me a favor? Could you go up there and maybe say a couple of words, say a Tehillim, and maybe say the Kel Mali Rachamim, you know, or Kaddish at the end. Can you do that? It's like, I know I'm the religious guy here, the only religious guy in the kibbutz. Well, whatever, I'll go up and I'll do it. So he goes, and he goes up, he says some words about life and death and meaning and purpose, says a Tehillim, says this Kaddish, and that's it. So a few days later, this cousin, this female cousin, calls this boy back and says, you're not going to believe what happened. Says, what happened? He said, let me tell you the whole story. So we get back home to Shiva, and she says, and my brother's at Shiva, you know, he is totally irreligious. And he's a botanist, and all he does is deal with plants, nothing else. And he's always said, like, you guys in this burial deal, like, I have no interest in it. I have nothing to do with it, you know? Plants, those are things that come from the ground. Me, I'll be ashes. I'll be burnt. You can sprinkle me all over my plants. I don't care. I don't buy into any of these things. So he's sitting on a chair when we get home, and he says, you know, when our cousin spoke, and he said that Kaddish, and he said that to Hillam, that really hit me. It was like unbelievable. You know, I realized at that moment, I want a Jewish burial. I want a Jewish burial. That's it. That's it. And they're like, what? Where did this come from? It's like, I don't know. Something about the way he spoke. I want a Jewish burial. I need to have a Jewish burial. So he said, you know, I'm reminded of like my bar mitzvah, where I had like a talis that I got from my bar mitzvah. Do you know where that talis is? So the sister said, I mean, it's in the same place it was when you used it the last time, which was on your bar mitzvah. That was the last time you ever took that thing out of the bag, and you're 31 years old right now. Like, you know, we don't know where it is. I really want that talis. I really want it. Okay? So, okay, I don't have it. The next day, he's sitting on his chair again, and he's again waxing and waning. He's like, I really, really want that talis. Please find that talis for me. So like, okay, well, look. So he went to look for the talis. They find it, like, dug up somewhere. They pull it out of its bag. Here we found the talis. Oh, so glad, I'm so thrilled. He throws in the talis. He opens the talis. He's like, oh, this feels so beautiful. Feels so amazing. He's sitting on his chair. He's lying back on his chair. He picks it up, opens it like a blanket, puts it over himself, and at that moment he has a heart attack and he dies. Right? And I was like, whoa. And the woman says to her cousin, she says, do you understand that you brought him to tshuva the last moments of his life? He had a thought within his own life that he wants to accept upon himself Jewish burial and everything else. Somehow, just by acting normal, you brought this man, my brother, to a place of total tshuva. Unbelievable. Like he wanted it. He said, like he even said when he was in Shire, when I die, I want to be buried in this. I want to be able to be buried in my talis, just like I saw, like at the funeral. And he basically covered himself for that. Right? Point of this whole thing is that we have no idea what effects we're going to have just by acting normal. Not by being forceful and telling a person something. There is an approach that says maybe be forceful so you can get other people to listen. But it doesn't mean necessarily that's the right approach. I will interject that I've noticed in particular for Russians that Russians work better by being forceful. Oftentimes, Russian men work better by being forceful, but they have to temper it. You will see that times that there is a famous story. I'm trying to remember to Rav Yitzchak Zilber, who it's a little bit opposite of the story. You know the story? And the story was that he had to get this man to give a get to his wife, to give a divorce paper to his wife. You know the story? And the woman and the guy's like, I'm not doing it. So he was older already, like late 70s or whatever, something like that. And he goes over to me and says, look, you need to give a get to your wife. You have to do it. He says, I'm not doing it. So he repeats to me, you need to do it. He said, Rabbi, if you tell it to me again, I'm going to punch you in the face. So he says, you need to give a get to your wife. And this man goes and turns and punches this elderly rabbi in the face and he falls to the ground. You know? I don't know, broken jaw, bleeding face, whatever it is. He's like, oh my goodness, I can't believe what I just did. I just hit the rabbi. So he's like, I'm so sorry. He picks him up and the rabbi gets him and goes, I told you, you need to give your wife a get. You know? And like, they just, you know, they say, you just have to be a little bit forceful. But I found it in two different ways. I found it, number one, Russians one way, Israelis a little bit differently in this, but it's not so clear. And either way, from a lot of the postgame, it doesn't seem like you're just forceful. One of the reasons why a lot of these people online who are giving their class online are getting a lot of people to follow them is they're not necessarily being forceful to those people. I'm not telling you directly something. You're listening to a class that I gave to a crowd over here, and you're listening in your own time. You don't feel like I'm actually attacking you directly. And that's why maybe you can, there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance there. You can hear it. You don't feel like you're being attacked. And that's why it might actually work. So the keys over here in rebuke, it seems that our mitzvah to rebuke is because you want to bring a person into the fold. Yet at the same time, we don't actually have a right to go and attack people for what they're doing. Your job is to actually try to accommodate them, get them to do this. Come on, man, you can do it. Try it. One Shabbos, another Shabbos. I don't know if someone told me this story that one of these guys on Facebook was going on Facebook and he would post every week, hey guys, try to keep one more minute of Shabbat that you haven't kept before. One minute more. And then a guy responded like 3 years later saying, I just want to let you know that I listened to your post, I was watching your post every week, keep 1 minute Shabbat, and today, after 3 years, I finally have kept my full Shabbos. Right? So it was like, wow, wait, 1 minute at a time. That's a lot. 60 times 25, what's this? That's a long time. It's taking like many years, you know? But the point is that by getting a person little by little to do it is somewhat helpful. That's the concept over here.
But if we have like a, just like throwing the number, but if we have majority actually not doing anything, and that is without the judgment, and people like looking everything that's around them like certain way, and when they even look at the rabbis, the majority of the rabbis they're going to see different rabbis.
Right? Yeah, they're not doing anything either.
Yes, and all of a sudden all the judgment goes like, you know, not with the different divination of Judaism.
Honestly, I think if you're around these people and they see you doing something, they know, a lot of them know what's right. They just don't want to do it. They're not ready to do it. So you have to get them little by little. I told you like last week, you have to get them little by little. Remember how, you know, oh, it was amazing how you did this properly, you know? Judaism says you have to do this, and also says you have to keep Shabbos. Why don't you try keeping Shabbos this week? Maybe don't do Borer. Maybe don't sort your cutlery this Shabbos. Maybe don't sort your laundry. Maybe don't dig a ditch. Don't garden your garden this week. Stop it with one thing. You know, so you can help them. We're not telling you that you're attacking them or rebuking them, you know. We're telling you that you can get them to do one thing at a time. Now, the fact is, like, look, I have some neighbors that, like, they don't do anything, you know. I have one neighbor that's very religious, one neighbor that's not Jewish, who runs a company that's Jewish, but he's not Jewish. It's called Mike Stern Plumbing. I'm like, wow, he's Jewish. No, I bought it from him. His name is Jose Ortiz. He's not Jewish. You know? But I have one neighbor that's not religious at all. Is there anything I'm actually going to be able to say to them? In many cases, unlikely. You know, you wish him a good shabbos. If you have a relationship with the person, go, hey, you want to come for a meal? Hey, you want to maybe not do this? You know, hey, did you know? You can't drive on Shabbos, you know? So a lot of people know these things. It's just a matter of when will they bring themselves to get to that point. They have to come and make that decision. Sometimes it's going to be your comment that's going to get it there, and sometimes it's going to be something that's going to get them to push themselves there. Remember, it's younger the person, the easier it is. The older the person, it gets harder.
What I've run into is they say, oh, well, you know, that's fine for you because you're Orthodox, but I'm Reform. I'm conservative. I'm Reconstructionist.
Right, so the answer to that is, oh, you are? Can you tell me what value systems, the platforms they stand on? What is the view of Reform? Well, you know, we don't do this. But why? They don't have an idea what their platform is. What's their platform? The Reform's platform is basically, we don't believe the Torah came from heaven. We may not believe in God. We certainly don't believe in the rabbis. And Judaism is a nice way for me to do tikkun olam. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, they don't even know that. Right? Do they even know that 13% of Reform rabbis don't believe in God? Do they know that?
Wow.
They probably don't know that, right? So they don't know what their platform is based on. Like, why are you Jewish in the first place? I mean, like, is Jewish any different than Native American for you? Like, what's the difference? So, like, they don't know what their platform is. Most conservative people not be able to tell you what their platform is. What will they be able to tell you? We're a mix between Reformer and Orthodox. What is that? What's a mix? We're not in a kennel, you know? What's a mix? What does it mean, we're a mix? So what does it actually mean? They don't usually understand what that platform is based on. If you can explain to them, there's a fascinating shiur that Rabbi Mati Berger gives to Meshach Torah, and he explains the difference between Orthodox Reform, Orthodox conservative Reform, and everything else to the left of that, and then Christianity and Islam. And the basis of the platforms are that the basic tenets of faith that the Orthodox believe in, Islam and Christianity are closer to Orthodoxy than Reform and Conservative are. Because if you think about it, they believe in God. Those, let's say Christianity and Islam, they believe in God. They believe in, Islam believes in the oneness of God. Christianity has, you know, split. They believe the Torah was God-given, right? But they, at some point, they believe that it was, might have branched off or something else and the like, right? Whereas in Reform, they don't necessarily believe that. Conservative, some parts of that they do. Rabbinic Judaism, they don't, right? So these are deviants of it, but most of them, they don't understand the platforms that they have. And that's why we usually like to define it as like this. There are two types of Jews. There are those that are practicing and those that are not practicing. That's it. Right? Now, a person may say, I'm a practicing conservative Jew. Well, why do you do this? You ever wonder why you do this? I remember a conservative rabbi that told me once, you know, the rabbis made a mistake 70 years ago when they allowed people to drive on Shabbos. It was a mistake that they made. Like, you now, the conservative rabbis of today, are seeing the mistake that was made in their quote-unquote psak halacha that they gave, that it was permissible for them to actually drive. Like, well, it's hard for us to revoke it. We don't have that concept because of the fact that we don't really have the concept of the rabbis making mistakes. Not that they're not infallible, but we understand that the process that they came through to get to it had a certain modality. There was like, sight changing of the times, let's do it. But you see what happened with conservatism. Once they allowed you to drive, communities actually got broken up. And nobody lived in enclaves anymore. They all lived spread out because I can go to my shul, synagogue, wherever I can go. So in most of these cases, people don't even know why they believe what they believe. They just assign themselves to this thing because it's easier. It's an easier way of life. You know, I'm not conservative. Conservative is going to make me go to shul and Shabbos. I'm Reform because Reform doesn't make me go. That's not what their policies are. You just do what you want. So get them in talking points.
Oh, I'm Reform, so I can eat bacon because Reform lets me eat bacon.
Right. So the answer is, can you show that to me where it is in the book? I'd love to see that. And what's the proof that they have? They don't know. I'm saying so. It's what we call tinuk shenish, but the person is really in a state of unknown. They have no real clue of what they're saying about themselves, and you know, you feel bad. You go, I get that, but like, you know, Like, you know, it's funny because I'm Orthodox, and Orthodoxy actually says that you can punch people in the face whenever you want. So you better watch out. I'm coming your way, right? It's like, where does it say that? What's the proof to this? I don't have any proof to this whole thing over here. So how, where are you coming up with it, you know?
Can you explain the difference between the different platforms?
Who's the rabbi?
Yeah.
Rabbi Motti Berger. I have M-O-T-T-Y. I have his shiur recorded, and I think I took the notes on it. Well, he gave it by us like about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. It's unfortunate that people, they're assigning themselves to platforms not because they have a belief system. Hey, you know, in Reform you can get married to a non-Jew. Why is that? Well, because they don't have patrilineage. Well, it's not based on anything. It's based on whatever fits the times and whatever they're in the mood for. You know, so it's very hard to... You're not getting into that argument with them. Let's put it that way. Let me hold off.
I think okay. Also the Jews who identify with Reform who are confused. I have a...
Honestly, there are plenty of Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jews who are confused. You know, some, when they align themselves with certain parties or with certain religious levels, they're confused. They're just like, this is where we go. They don't see the difference.
I think the person that I'm thinking of, she grew up Reform. I went to Chabad one day. She's like, oh, I'm going to come with you. And then, like, oh, I'm going to go to this shul. Like, oh, no, I don't want to. Like, does that make sense?
You said you don't want to.
Oh, no, this girl.
Didn't want to.
But then she goes, like, to Chabad and has this, like, a really deep conversation.
Right. So, again, there. A lot of times they're spiritual, but they don't want to align themselves to any areas of Orthodoxy because it's going to feel like it's judgmental on them. We go back to the same judgmental aspect of it. Okay? Let me just jump to this other point over here. Okay, so we said about Lashon Hara speaking negatively, we said about rebuke. So now there's just the point over here is what our goal is, we actually have to become role models. It's very important today, we have to become role models. I did hear someone listened to a class, I don't want to quote from who yet because I don't know if it's public, but the idea is today, we live in a time that there's so much, not irreligiosity, there's so much lack of godliness in the world that people don't even have belief in God, that instead of just trying to make people religious, we need to start promoting people to believe in God. Focus on them, even if they're not going to become fully religious, but focus on them actually having a stronger belief system in God. Understand what emunah is about, what real faith is about, and developing these aspects of God. It's almost as if we're living in a time when Avram Avinu was teaching people about God. There are many, many people that don't even have that belief about God, and we need to reintroduce that into their world to understand the basics. And many of us have that ability to really just explain that idea of godliness. So we have to, at this point, become role models to people. We need to be loving and caring. The Torah says, "Darachei darchei noham," that the ways of the Torah are pleasant. We have to show people the pleasantness of Torah. The pleasantness of Torah is what they have to, you know, what they want to see. If they see you, you're stuck up and you're rigid, then they don't want to be part of it. So we had a discussion after class last time, and that is that, like, we oftentimes people will shun away other people. I don't want to deal with you, you know? You're getting in the way of my religion, of my religious experience. And the answer is, but they have to look at you that you are the epitome of religion. If you're the epitome of religion, then what that means is they have to see you in this beautiful light, and they say, oh, I want this. I love how this person loves me so much and cares about me. So if they see you and you're just shutting them down, they don't want to have anything part of it. You know, so imagine a person who exercises, and during the exercise they're screaming in pain, and after exercise they're screaming in pain, and they go, "Hey, you want to join me in exercise next week? No, thanks. I'm going to pass." You know, so I'm sitting there and I'm studying, and I'm mean, and I'm pushing you away, and I don't want to hear anything about your life. I don't want anything to do with you. They go, and now you want to teach me Torah? You didn't care about me. Why should I care about you now? And that's the point we have to make for ourselves is, Darachei darchinom, we have to show the pleasantness of it. We have to show the beauty of it. We have to show the beauty of what it really is all about. And that's really just like praising the people, seeing beautiful things, seeing Torah on their face, and bringing that out for them, and saying like, wow, you shine like gems, like you remind me of the story of whatever. And you bring up the story. But obviously it's got to be an easy flow. You know, I was looking at your face, you remind me of Lovan, you know? Really, it's just a... Did I ever tell you about Lovan? It wasn't such a great guy, you know? Like, obviously you want to do it in the proper way. You cannot ignore people in this area. You know, you have to learn to speak their language. And of course, if they're your own children, then you have to take extra special care for them. Don't ever push them away, no matter really what the age is, what we're dealing with. we're going to go into a couple of some other topics here. This is, let me just see where I am over here. Basically, two more topics, and then we'll go for questions. Okay. so we spoke about lashon hara, we spoke about rebuke, becoming a role model, and now it's attending prohibited marriages. Okay, a little bit difficult topic. There's different types of prohibited marriages. There's prohibited marriages of Jew to non-Jew. There's other prohibited marriages of kohen to divorcee. Other types of marriages of a person to a mamzer. Or mamzeret. Remember, mamzeret is a person who was born out of wedlock. What's a person who's born out of wedlock? So you have woman A is married. Well, there's only one woman. Woman is married to a man. They don't get a get. They don't get a proper divorce. And they had a legal marriage. If they had a proper legal marriage, halachic marriage, and they did not get a divorce, and then she goes, she didn't get a halachic divorce, she goes and marries somebody else, they have a child, that child is a mamzer, or mamzeres for a woman, and they're not allowed to ever marry into the Jewish people. They can only marry another mamzer, mamzeres, who went through the same thing, or a convert. But that lives in perpetuity, and their kids are forever mamzerim. Okay, so can you attend a marriage where you have a person who's not a mamzer marrying a mamzer? Can you attend a marriage where you have a person who is a divorcee marrying a kohen? And obviously you get to the scenarios of non-Jews. so we're just talking about attending. We're not saying that you're officiating at the wedding. That's obviously prohibited. We're just talking about, can you attend as an individual? You're allowed to attend these things. So there's no hard, fast rule in this particular area. The basic issue that we're dealing with in this area is what we call machzike ovrei avera. Am I giving strength to those that are actually violating the sin? Am I basically promoting it? So you're doing this, am I promoting you actually doing this? So which means you get a call from cousin so-and-so and say, you know, I just got engaged. Oh really, what's the guy's name? And his name is Chris Christensen, right? Don't worry, his mother's Jewish. Okay, then it's not an issue. But you got engaged to a guy who's not Jewish, and I want you to come to the wedding. I don't know. But more than that, I want you to be the best man at the wedding, or whatever, bridesmaid at the wedding, or something like that, right? So it's two different questions that are associated over here. So the question is, when I go to this wedding, am I aiding and abetting? Am I supporting this person and saying that I'm strengthening their irreligious observance or their sinning behaviors? That is the major question. So today the commentaries say that, or the authorities in halacha say, today when we're dealing with people who are irreligious, we're not talking about someone who was religious and no longer. We're talking about and in many cases, those cases, they maybe never had a proper taste of religion anyway. But let's say we're taking someone who is irreligious, didn't grow up religious, and they say, I'm marrying a non-Jew, can you attend the wedding? So there's two major factors here. Major factor number one is that, are we supporting their behavior, their sinning behavior? that's one issue, and that would be a problem on my side. But on the other side, then you have the issue is, am I going to create a Chil Hashem? Is there going to be animosity that's going to be created? Is there going to be a sense of hatred that is going to develop over here? So so the answer is basically like this. In many cases, when they're irreligious, by you going to the wedding, they're not feeling like, wow, they're really supporting my non-religious marriage. They're not feeling that. Why? Because they don't know really anything about it. Even if they knew about it once in the background, you told them once, and the like, they don't really know anything about it. So many of the commentaries say that today, since it's such a distant experience to them, you going is not going to cause them to say that you're aiding and abetting them. Therefore, it would be okay. Unless, of course, the person is known to be a rabbi or something else of stature, where they say, wow, the rabbi came to this wedding, then it's a problem. Then it would be a problem. Then it might present a Chil Hashem there, because then they think you're aiding and abetting them in that area. So this question is a double-sided question. Will it be a Chil Hashem if you go? Maybe it's desecrating God's name. You're going since you're showing them that you approve of this. And the other one is, will the family be so angered that it's going to create discord and distance this Jew from the possibility of returning? So the answer is that if, again, you're not the rabbi, you're just an average individual relative, you could potentially go because you're not promoting it. You didn't cause them to want to do it even more. It's not like they felt you blessed them with it. And by you coming, it might actually help them come back and say, oh, my religious relative was there, you know, like I don't have hatred towards him. And you might be able to open the doors in the future to get them to other things. It's quite possible you could get them to do other things. However, they do recommend in that scenario that it's best not to stay long at the wedding. Go, show your face, do what you need to do, but don't stay long at the wedding in that scenario.
What about being in the wedding where one person is not Jewish?
Well, that is what we're dealing with now, right? What does it mean, being in the wedding? Being the bride or the groom?
No, like being like a bridesmaid.
So that's a separate thing. So that was the second part of that, right? So the second part of that is really what they call shoshvinin. Shoshvinin are the people that are usually like the ones that are like kind of promoting the wedding. They're walking the people down the aisle, things like that. And perhaps a bridesmaid might fit under that category also. So there it would be recommended, they say, that you shouldn't do that. So if it's a prohibited marriage... Okay. Well, there's always a future for us, right? In a prohibited marriage, going to divorcee, same thing. So like, look, you know, I'll show up, but I'm not really, I don't want to, you know, take part in these things. I want to, you know, sit in the side. And you shouldn't walk, so you shouldn't walk them down the aisle and the like, you know?
Both of them Jewish.
What
are both of them Jewish?
But?
Okay, there is a lot of but. First, the food is not kosher.
Fine.
Women are singing.
Fine.
Mixed dancing. It's,
fine.
It's a lot of problems.
Well, the question is like this. What does it mean women are singing? Under the chuppah?
I'm saying like at the party. Like they have a...
Okay, we're not talking about the party now.
They have a band.
No, I didn't say it. I'm not talking about the party. I'm talking simply right now about the chuppah part because that's a part of the holiness aspect of it. Should you attend? So that ideally, you don't want to attend for that part. Ideally, you say, let me show up for the party. Okay? And show up for the party.
What if it's a kind of like reform? Like chuppah... You know,
so. Because they'll show up because you're not aiding and abetting them. If they feel like, oh, the religious Rabbi Sergei is coming, so, you know, so therefore, you know, he's now acknowledging that this is the right way to go, so that's a separate story, right? We're not saying that. We're saying that the average individual wants to go to this wedding because there's going to be animosity. That's the main reason. Not if you don't need to go. There's going to be animosity, there's going to be some hatred, and you want to be able to bring them back closer. So you have leniency to be able to attend this wedding. There's leniency to be able to attend, but don't take part in anything. And you realize that whatever they're doing, it's not kosher. The whole thing's not kosher. It's not a marriage. It's not a valid marriage. You know, the famous line they say, Rav Yitzchak Berkowitz would say, when the guy calls and says he's engaged to a non-Jew, you go, oh, you must be so happy. Right? You get it?
So
you get it? Mm-hmm. Right? You don't say, oh, I'm so happy for you, Mazel Tov. You say, oh, you must be so happy. Right? I'm not acknowledging, I'm not wishing bracha on you in any way, you know? You go, oh, mazel ra, you know? I'm not saying something bad at you, you know? I'm just saying like...
So if I could just throw kind of a curveball, what if it's a family member who is marrying a non-Jew and they ask you to be in it as a groomsman, a bridesmaid, whatever... And you know, if you say no, then there will be animosity.
Right. So that's a great question because I think that is a classic example that we're going to deal with. That issue is going to be, look, I'm really happy for you, not me. I'm not happy. I'm really happy for you, and I want to be there for you at the wedding because I know it means a lot to you, but I'm really not comfortable in taking part in anything. Okay, because you know. You know, you're marrying a non-Jew, if you feel comfortable saying that, you know, if they don't already know, you know, they're not Jewish, what? Right? I wish somebody would have told me. Quick, get me, you know. But the point is that you go with them and say, look, I'm going to be there for you, but I really don't feel comfortable taking part of those things. So I'm going to be there at the wedding, but please don't ask me to be, please don't ask me to be something.
Well, I guess my question is, if that does create a situation where the person's like, oh, you know,
you're so religious, my brother,
my family member, you know, oh, you know, he's a crazy religious guy, and he wouldn't be in my way, and I am going to hold that grudge.
Well, you're not. You're going to the wedding.
No, no, but to actually be in it, if you turn down like being in it, and they say like, oh, you know, I'm going to hold a grudge against him or her because he disrespected me by not.
I mean, so you can say to them like this. I'm here for you. Would you rather I don't go to the wedding, or would you rather come to the wedding and not be part of the whatever the ceremony? You know, what would you rather do? You know, so you can present those too. You know, obviously it's like if you're trying to be able to say in such a way like I'm respecting you, but I have my boundaries, and it's going to be a key in all of these things is. Can you respect me and at the same time, can I respect you and you respect me? There are going to be things that are going to be no. And those are going to be some of the struggles that we're going to have. Hey, I need you to taste my, you know, my baby pork rib sandwich. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. Now, again, if I told you I was vegan, oh, you would praise me and, amazing. Wow, my cousin's vegan. This one's kosher, though. Give me a break. What a loser. You know what? But the vegan one is like such a special human being, right? That's always is. Why? Because vegan is not about me. Vegan is about you and your care for animals and or whatever it is, right? And plant products and the like, you know? So, but there's no attack on me. But once you tell me I'm kosher, like, I'm kosher and you're not. Okay, so they know there's that divisiveness that happens over there. But remember, it's the same thing. If someone says to you, oh, why don't you take some? I'm vegan. Oh, wow, sure, no problem. Where do you want to go? Someplace else? Right? Oh, I'm kosher. Right? Like, and there's this double standard over here. But we'll have tremendous respect if you're vegan. So in these scenarios, you have to be able to have boundaries to be able to say to them, hey, listen, you know, I'd love to be there, but I can't. This is as far as I can go. Back to that question about, you know, music and everything else over there. So, number one, I wouldn't look at the band leader. There's your first leniency. Knowing you're coming in, don't take a single look at the band leader. There's leniency that if you don't know what the singer looks like, then you're okay. Right? Number two, you can bring earplugs if you want. You go, you know, these bands are so loud, I gotta put earplugs in, you know? That's an easy way out of it. Mixed dancing, walk out. Sometimes when there is no mechitza dancing, so and then there's women dancing here, men dancing here, I will always, well, I'm giving it away, but I will always go in the inner circle. I'll always dance in the inner circle, counting the outer men as a mechitza for me. That's how I do it. So it's like they don't know that they're acting as a separation for me, but that's how I count them as my mechitza for me. Once the inner circle becomes the outer mechitza, right, which means it disbanded, then I just either walk away or I start a new inner circle in there. So then I'm always going to be in the inner circle. That's how to get around it. You know, as far as kosher food, you know, some woman called me and said, can you do my wedding? It's not going to be kosher, but we'll bring you kosher food. I don't want your food, you know? I don't want to. I'm going to sit there with my kosher food here like I'm at a business meeting and you're eating non-kosher there. I'd rather not eat. You know, I wouldn't stay to actually eat for the thing at all. You know, that's the person in my own preference. But technically, I think you could do a wedding in those scenarios. Would you stay for the meal? Don't stay for the meal, you know? Or stay outside or whatever and the like. Again, these are, because the goal is you want to bring them back in. You want to bring them into the fold. You want to show yourself and bring them in. So you have to realize that goal in mind.
So you go kind of for the ceremony, but the rest, you say no.
It's better, obviously, to go for the not ceremony. You know, you don't want to give any credence to sin, but if you have to be there, you're not aiding and abetting that. You know, oh, we just showed up, you know, I was in the middle of watching the football game, I totally forgot, you know, about your wedding to this guy, you know? I mean, I've been to weddings where, like, the bride, groom, I mean, not the bride, where the groom, groom's father, they're all, like, watching the game, you know? Like, right before they're going down to the chuppah. You know, it's like, I'm a big Bronco fan. I got to see what's going on over here before we go, you know. The bride's like, thinking she's crying, all these things. The guy's like, oh my goodness, I hope we get this touchdown. You know, he's like, totally not there, you know. But that's men. not all men. Last topic for now, and then we'll take questions, and that is going to non-kosher restaurants. So some of you may be what we call out of the issue already. But some people are still in the issue, and that is a question of going to non-kosher restaurants. What does it mean? It means that a person is, you know, either newly religious, they have their non-religious family members around, and they're like, listen, Devorah, Chaim, Yanko, whatever, we've been to your, like, bagels and lox restaurant for, like, 7 times in a row now, Is there anything else that we can go to? So in California, it's like, yeah, we have like 40 restaurants to choose from. But if you're living in like Bakersfield, if you're living in who knows where else, most other states, it's like, how many times am I going to eat that same bagel and lox, you know, in your kosher restaurant? Can we go to something else a little bit more fancier? You know, is there something else? You know, we're just kind of bored of it. Can we go somewhere else? So are you allowed to go and attend with your family into a non-kosher restaurant? So the commentaries discuss a number of different questions here. Can I go in and not eat there? Or can I go in there and get my kosher food and eat there? Right? So it's another level in that scenario. So the main issue that we have that's associated here is called what we call Maris Ayin and Chashad. Two different issues. Moshe Feinstein points out these two issues. Maris Ayin is when someone's going to see you, they're going to look at you, that you're doing something, and they're going to think that it's permitted for you to do. The key is they're watching you going to McDonald's. Wow, I didn't know this McDonald's was kosher. I'm going to go in. There was a restaurant in Pico called Brooklyn Pizza, Brooklyn Pasta and Pizza on Pico Boulevard, and it opened up kosher. It opened up kosher, had a hechsher, the whole deal. And then at some point, the guy switches to non-kosher into a pizza bar. My wife goes in for lunch one day, unbeknownst to her, that this restaurant is totally trafe now. Like, hardcore. It's like, oh, this pizza's already here. I know it's kosher. We went in. They went in. They sit down. The manager comes and goes, by the way, we're not kosher anymore. So, wow. At least thank you for telling me instead of trying to serve me. But he knew that. So here was the scenario that obviously the restaurant switched in the middle. But let's say you're going to a real non-kosher restaurant. Give me an example of one. In and out. It's really high end. Let's see. Let's say you're going to whatever, I don't know. Oh, that's high end? That's high end? Okay.
Better than In-N-Out.
Better than In-N-Out, okay. I didn't think that was high end either. I thought you were going to something else, but I don't know the names of the higher end ones. Fine. Like Taco Bell, maybe, you know. Del Taco, right? So the issue of Maris Ayin is you're going to go in there, and someone's going to see you going in there and go, wow, I guess this place is kosher. That's one. Chashad is the concept that you're going to go and do a sin. You're going to do something and people think, wow, that guy's a violator of Torah. They don't keep Torah. They're not so one is that I'm going to think that it's permitted what you're doing. The other is I'm going to think you are doing a major sin. Those are two distinct areas based on the pasuk in the Torah's V'isim Nikim Hashem Amei Yisrael. And the concept is from that verse in the Torah where Moshe is telling this over to the tribes of Gad and Reuven that you have to go and fight the battle before you try to take the land of the Transjordan. And he says you have to be cleansed from the Hashem and from the Jewish people. The Jewish people are going to judge you. They're going to think you're doing something wrong. And you have to be cleansed from that. You have to be cleansed of all judgment. So this concept is that I cannot be assuming that I'm doing something wrong, even if I'm not doing it wrong. But because onlookers will think I'm doing it wrong, that is a problem unto itself. So can I enter into these restaurants? Moshe Feinstein, by the way, it's kind of a longer topic, but makes it explicit that one cannot go into a conservative reformed temple. Okay, this is a major issue. Cannot go into a conservative reformed temple because of the fact people are going to think that you're praying there. And you're giving credence to what they're doing. So this is a very difficult scenario. And people think this is what you're doing. Because a lot of times you're like, I have to go. I have a cousin's bar mitzvah. What am I supposed to do in this particular area, right? Moshe was very much against it. I spoke to a Rav, must have been like 3 years ago, who allowed someone from New York to come to our area and to go to a bar mitzvah in the conservative temple. And I called him, like, how'd you allow this? He said, well, because nobody around knows who the guy is. He's not allowed to pray during services. He can attend. But if you feel, he said to me, if you feel that other people are going to look and say, look, this is permitted, you can go there, then you can tell him he's not allowed to go there. He says, based on your town, so I don't know your town, it's based on your town. If you feel that other people are going to align with this, then it poses a problem. So in general, we would not be allowed to go during times of prayers. We would not be allowed to go into a conservative or reformed temple because what they're doing is wrong. So it is a problem, and I know, I remember growing up, I went to a cousin's bar mitzvah in a conservative place, but I didn't know the halacha over here. People are going to think you're doing a direct prohibition by going in there. So if it's a side room, then there's permissibility. And if it's a separate doorway, then that's even better. So that's a problem. I remember someone called me and they said they wanted to take a job as a teaching assistant or something like that to do some, maybe it was Title I stuff. And there was a Korean monastery that was around there, and the teaching would be in the garage, but the monastery is in the front room, in the main room. So only if there was a secondary entrance that went to this garage would he even be allowed to go in. But even though he's not going to be doing any teaching in the monastery aspect of it, he was not allowed to go into that door. So no one should ever think that this is an okay thing to do. Even though he's only going teaching, but he wasn't allowed to even teach in that way unless it was a separate entrance that he can actually go into. Question.
So walking in the restaurant. So two questions. One of them is you walk in a restaurant to use the restroom.
Okay, we're not there yet. I'm going to go through those right now, okay? So the question is like the same thing with the restaurant. So is the conservative Reformed temple the same thing as a restaurant? So it would seem that it is the same thing. According to Rav Moshe, it would be the same thing. We have dispensations. That's why I asked specifically for a fancy restaurant, which is why In-N-Out was the first one chosen. I'm sure they'll use this as part of their promotional material. But whatever it was, Cheesecake Factory, right? But the question was that if I'm going to, let's say, McDonald's, but I need to use the bathroom, can I do it? So that's a classic scenario. Again, we're talking about the relatives here, but I'll go into the classic scenario is you're on a road trip and you stop in at whatever, McDonald's to go use the bathroom. Everyone knows that that's the bathroom in the area. You can stop in there. Well, nobody says you're assuming that you're going for the actual get a cheeseburger and the like. Or you're going to get a drink. That might be permissible also because that's the only drink in the area. But if you're up on Pico Boulevard and there's 35 restaurants, you go, you know what, I'm going into McDonald's because I want to use the restroom. That's a problem. You could have gone into everybody else, and you didn't, so that is a problem. People would be choshesh you. People would suspect you for doing something that would be improper. So if it's a scenario where that's what people do, they use that to go there. Like if you go into 7-Eleven, no one's thinking you're getting a hot dog. They assume you're getting, you know, a banana for like $8, but not a hot dog, you know? That's what they assume at that point. So that's when you're dealing with a regular restaurant. But if you're dealing with an expensive restaurant, nobody goes into expensive restaurants just to be able to use the bathroom. Right? They'll usually go into some other cheaper restaurant. If you're walking into an expensive restaurant, it's like, what's going on? You must be doing something. So therefore, people say that that would not be proper for you to walk into that expensive restaurant. What am I supposed to do? My family's going. How am I going to deal with this? So some of the commentaries, I think, of Yaakov Kamenetsky presents the idea that if there is reasonable concept or cause to say that you went for something else, and there's reason to believe you're doing something else, then it's okay. If there's no reason to believe that, then it would not be okay. But if there is some doubt that perhaps you're going for something else, it has to be reasonable doubt, then it would be okay. So what would that be? So for example, people go to certain places for business meetings. So it's midday, mid-afternoon, certainly in Midtown Manhattan, people go there for business meetings all the time. You can walk in there and you're going to, you know, you'll get your orange, unpeeled orange, right? That's one concept. But there's another concept that if you go in, some present the idea that if you go in with a folder or a binder, or a briefcase, it looks like, oh, you're going in for business, so that's a better way to deal with it. Certainly for men, you would go in with a baseball cap or some other sort of hat on in order to show that you're not promoting, you know, you're not like a religious Jew sitting there. For women, it's less of an issue. They don't have to worry about going in, so that's not a problem. But Moshe Sternbach presents the idea that it's best to put some sort of other head covering on so you don't stand out by it. I know people do this when they're driving, like, quick, take off your kippah, I'm about to make an illegal turn, you know? It's like, rip it off, and then, you know, it's like, okay, that's not the best idea. One time I was a passenger, and I was like, I'm taking off my kippah over here, this is terrible, you know? Like, I'm like, I can't let other people see me in this car, you know? but that's the idea, meaning you have to find ways to get, when you go dealing with family, it doesn't mean you go, look, I know it's difficult for you to go to these kosher restaurants, but it's really uncomfortable for me to go there because, A, I'm not going to eat. It's really uncomfortable. But when you are forced, if there's ways to get around it so people would not suspect you in any way, such as you're carrying in a briefcase, you have something else that you're carrying that it makes it look like you're doing it for something else, then there is some reason for it to do it. Should you eat there? It's probably best that you don't eat there. I remember when I was at work at Payne Weber many years ago, so they took us to this restaurant, so you have a partner. I remember two different times. One time I was working for Price Waterhouse, and they took us to this like Indian bar, whatever it was. And I was there with two other religious Jews and a partner. And they all ordered beer. Now, at the time, I wasn't sure if you're allowed to drink beer with non-Jews. Wine, you can't do. Right? It's a cool question, can you drink beer with non-Jews? So I sat there with my bottle, and I poured it into a cup, and I kept going like this. And I had like foam on my lip, but I never drank a sip. You know, I just kept going like, wow, this guy's like, his cup is always full. You know, I'm just a positive person, you know? So, I didn't drink a sip. And I was watching my manager, who was Jewish, and another coworker was Jewish, with kippahs on their heads, that they would bring out like this fried food, breaded fried food, vegetables and the like, but it was fried in their deep fryer, and they were just eating it the whole time. As the partner was talking, the partner got a meal, the other guys got a meal, and they were eating these things. I'm like, what is going on here? Here are people promoting themselves as religious Jews, and they're eating non-kosher in a non-kosher restaurant. So that's not marasayin, that's called violation. That's called sinning. That's one. Second thing was that I had another manager in a different company when I was another, and they took us down to the restaurant that was in the courtyard, and I just said, like, Diet Coke. You sure, nothing else? Diet Coke. I had like 7 glasses of Diet Coke while I was there. I was like, I'm in so much pain, but I'm not eating anything. Like, because they kept eating more food, and I was like, oh my goodness, like, it was by the 6th cup, I was like, I could barely swallow, you know, but that's what I did. Why? It was business. It was okay. Everyone knew that that's what you're going for was business. But that's the idea. If you're going in midday, and you see a bunch of partners going in, generally it's assumed to be business, and there would be permissibility.
So the first example, you had a responsibility to rebuke them.
I had a responsibility to rebuke them. I saw that I couldn't rebuke them. I've tried in other areas, you know, suggested. I don't think it was, and maybe I did rebuke them later. But like, you know, it's true. Could be I needed to rebuke them more. But I was like, when you see someone doing something so blatant, it's like, I don't think rebukes can work over here. I need another tactic, you know? So maybe I should have, but I didn't feel like, you're doing something blatant over here. Like, how am I supposed to tell you? Oh, they're like, oh, it's just vegetables. Like, you're deep frying vegetables in a non-kosher restaurant. There's no way that that's going to be kosher. Maybe they didn't know. I don't know. Maybe they've already done tshuva. I have no idea. You know, but that's the idea. Any other questions? So let's go through a review on what we had, and then I'll take a question. Okay. So just to review, we remember for ourselves that if we are rebuking or talking about people, we have to see, are we judging them negatively? Or can we think about, like, what can we do to bring them back in? What can we do to bring them back in? One. Second thing we spoke about was the idea of Lashon Hara, and that we would assume that they're not considered an apikoros, they're considered just a regular Rasha, and we have to do it for purpose that are important purposes. We discussed the idea of giving rebuke, that we should still try to give rebuke because it's important to them, but we generally don't have the opportunity, the correct ways to actually give rebuke today. If they're going to hate you or take revenge on you, then maybe you shouldn't rebuke them. And again, our goal is to bring them back closer. You have to become a role model, that the ways of Torah are pure and are sweet, and therefore you want them to feel that sense of purity and sweetness. And especially with our kids, we have to take extra care for them. Attending prohibited marriages, we said, is a major problem. But again, if they're clueless of you going, it has anything to do with your religious acceptance of it. Most likely it won't be, unless you're a person of high religiosity. They'll think that they're getting a blessing from the rabbi. Then it is a problem. Don't stay long at the wedding. Don't take part as part of the actual ceremony itself. It would not be right for a person to do that. And especially, again, non-Jewish wedding, ideally try to avoid. If you're forced, if you have to go for whatever particular reasons, so then there are leniencies we mentioned. Going to non-kosher restaurants, one that should be avoided whenever you can. If one is forced to do it, so putting on a hat, carrying your briefcase, some other thing that shows that you're coming, doing it for work, would be a better thing to do. You don't want other people to assume that you're doing something wrong. You know, as we mentioned, women don't necessarily have anything to have to cover. They don't look religious or non-religious as well. But people should not assume you're doing it, and therefore try to carry something with you that enables people to believe that you're going in for business. Any other questions?
But in general, or
in general, but you had something.
Question: close non-Jewish friends. You need to attend the funeral of their parents.
Not a problem.
Not a problem.
Not a problem.
Even if there is a pop doing some stuff.
You know, I would think that, you know, you wouldn't be facing him while he's doing any of the crisscrossing things, you know. I understand, whatever, I got it, you know. I would assume that you wouldn't be facing him doing that stuff, but it's not really such a problem to attend. Going into a church is a problem. Going into a church itself is a problem, especially if funeral is considered service, that is a problem. Going into a church in general is a problem. There's even a problem going to the Sistine Chapel. You just want to look at the art. That's a problem unto itself. But to attend the funeral, that seems to be like a cemetery, that would seem to be okay.
I know you touched on it a little bit about going into like a reform or conservative shul for a bar mitzvah. If that's your only choice because it's a family event, how do you go?
What do you mean it's your only choice? Not because there are other shuls there, but they need you to be there.
You need to be there because it's family. It's a family event.
Right. So again, ideally, if there are no other shuls in the area, great. It's better than because no one thinks you're going there. You like live in the middle of like, yeah. So then it obviously is a problem. I'm not gonna say it's not a problem, but assuming your back is against the wall, never daven there. Never say any words of prayer. They call you up for an aliyah. Sorry, not participating. You don't utter a word of prayer there at all. Not in the sanctuary, not during services, not after services. You don't pray in there at all. Certainly during their services, you wouldn't pray. So there are leniencies if a person has to go. Ideally, no one should see you going in. And if you have to go, yeah, obviously, even better, come when it's not a time for services, you know. But if a person did have to go, there are some leniencies, you know, that we try to avoid at all costs. But if you would go, you would not say any words of prayer at all. That would be, I mean, I remember learning it's like Rav Moshe was very adamant of not going in at all. Yeah, there are others that are a little bit more lenient, as long as you're not praying, you know. But it's a tight issue, you know, difficult issue.
So look, since you actually mentioned Rav Moshe, so it's so from one side, he's promoting the idea of the stolen baby and all the stuff that
nobody about what.
The Chinuch Tinish Bar.
Okay.
So this idea that people don't know exactly what's happening, so if anything they do, they don't know what they're doing.
Okay.
So not going to their events is kind of like, they don't know anything anyway.
But again, to go to a church, you're not allowed to go. Pesach Avodah Zarah. Church, yeah. To go to a conservative reform temple, you're not allowed to go. Whether the individual knows or doesn't know about what he's doing, that's a separate thing. But you can't attend these services in places that are going against the Torah. So it's not about you, the individual. It's about the whole communal organization of what it actually represents.
And another side, like every time we mention Judaism, we say it's a religion, right? In reality, we know it's not a religion.
Right. Correct. But that's how we deal with it.
How do we actually tell people properly that it's not a religion? It's a way of life, very much.
It's not that much that we say that Judaism is not a religion. It's more like this: if I use the terminology religion, then it means I have comparative religions, right? I have your religion, I have your religion, and my religion. So, hey, you got one, I got one. You know, I picked one up at Walmart. What did you pick up? It was on sale, you know. So, like, we have comparisons, but we want to say, like, there are no comparisons. There's those that follow God, and there's that don't follow God, right? Which means, then from the Torah side, there was paganism, and there was following God, right? So which means if you're a non-Jew, you had the seven Ohad laws, that's what you followed. But you were no different than the Jew who had 613, but you all followed the same God. Nowadays, most people are not, they don't understand that concept, and it's not something they're really going to explain to them. I don't think it's really worth the explanation. It's like, oh, actually, we don't have a religion, we have it. We've got it. You guys have religion, we have it. Like, who are you talking to? You know? Who's listening to you? Let's put it that way. I know who you're talking, but who's listening to you, you know, when you say that? So that, I don't know if there's a point in getting in that dialogue. That's my point. Any other thoughts?
Question. Company holidays, parties, if they provide you kosher food.
So most company holiday parties are not religious-based holiday parties, as far as I recall. So there are permissibilities to go there. If you're running a company, you shouldn't be putting up a tree. Even if you're Russian, and even if January 1st has some tree-related thing to it, you know, but you shouldn't be doing that. But it seems that most of these holiday parties, they're called holiday parties. It's like season's greetings. We don't want to, you know, we want to say a particular happy holiday to you, so with the leniency of that. So that's why it's always best when someone says, like, oh, happy Hanukkah, you go back and go, season's greetings, right? That's what you say. You don't want to give the holiday greeting itself, ideally. Right, so it would seem that if it's really holiday-based, meaning just festive-based and not specifically towards religion, especially in America where most people are religious, you know, in general, but they're trying to combine Kwanzaa, you know, Kratzmich and Hanukkah together, so it would seem that there's leniency to be able to go to those, you know? So that's our general understanding that we had. So we had a number of different laws. This is a little bit more rigid in the law base of how we deal with individuals, different than last week. But the goal is that we want to be able to be open to the non-religious people in our communities and our families and the like. We want to be a shining light to them. We want them to be able to see what we have is so beautiful. We'd love for them to take part of it. But if they don't want to, that's okay. We're not going to shove it down their throat. We're not going to wring their heads over it. You know, we want them to realize that we are the shining light. And if they want more, they'll come to us. And we do our best to bring them and include them into all the things that we're doing. That's what we'll end for this evening.